if you can imagine that Osama bin Laden died and he went to the afterlife, which he thought was heaven, the first person to greet him was a tall man, appeared to be George Washington, and he smacked him across the face. The next man walked up was Thomas Jefferson. He gave him a stiff uppercut in the gut. He's reeling. The third man walks up is Patrick Henry. He looks at him, spits right in his face. He says, wait a minute. Hey, gatekeeper, what's going on? Where are the virgins? He said, no, you misunderstood. It's 72 Virginians that you will spend eternity with. A little levity compliments of Ravi Zacharias. If he told that before 5,000 people, I could tell it. So, you like that, Steve? I thought I could tell it if Ravi did, but...
I like you.
Okay.
I knew it was coming, but I heard it.
I have confidence that if Osama bin Laden and George Washington ended up in the same place for eternity, that Washington would smack him, and probably several other things. In all seriousness, we're going to examine quickly the rise, spread, influence, and misperceptions concerning Islam. Let's pray. Our Father, we're thankful that as we come, we have a settled confidence that all truth is found in you. There's no such thing as relative. You set truth, and we thank you so much for that. As we examine facts of history and perceptions of people, may we bring them all into the prism of your truth. Thank you, Father, that we have confidence that in the end day, Jesus Christ shall reign, and all knees shall bow and confess that Jesus is Lord. We pray in his name. You could say that a strange wind blowing in the desert might sound like an odd title for a lesson or a lecture. But this is what it was, because blowing in the desert at this time was not this. What is the setting of the world in the 7th century? Come on. I'll hit it 8 times. You have to pay me extra if I have to hit 8 clicks to make the thing move. My fee just went up. A map of the known Western, what we would consider the modern world at the end around 50 A.D. They say CE. Of course, this is where the spread of the Roman Empire was. Rome controlled the lands that were light. By this time, the Rome still had a bishop. It was still dominant. First pope that we consider a modern pope, Gregory, came to the throne in 590. But setting in this, we know the church, come on. This is an outline of what I'd consider. Where did this come from? I'm so sorry. That's fine. It looks a little different up on the screen there. The church was really an Eastern church and a Western church, though the division had not officially occurred by this time. The Eastern church was known as the Byzantine. The Byzantine form of Christianity was found in predominantly the areas that you see here by the 600 Common Era, or AD as I choose to use it. As you can see, we have a pointer on here somewhere, Scott. Gotcha, bro. Yeah, you can see it surrounds the Mediterranean over into what's common today, Turkey, into the area, even closing into present-day Iraq. It had the whole Greece, the peninsula, up into the Balkans a little bit. It had, even Byzantine Christianity had spread even to southern Spain. The Byzantine capital was Constantinople. The emperor was most powerful. The bishop was under him. Church doctrine issues concerned Nestorians. Christ was the divine inhabiting the body of Jesus rather than who we know he was. The Monophysites, there were problems in the Byzantine church. The Arabian Peninsula Scott, I don't know how yours gave me all my things at once. That's okay. That's no problem. These little words should have come out later. That's okay. The Arabian Peninsula, as you see it, was an area at around 600 AD that you would say was filled first with polytheistic worship. The worship of the true God was only found up in the area of Jerusalem and along the Palestine area here. You had it spread, of course, over in here. But this area was essentially unchurched. The knowledge of God, the true God, was not available there. 570 AD was the birth of a man by the name of Muhammad. He was born in the town of Mecca. I believe we can see Mecca here. Muhammad was his name. He belonged to a powerful tribe, the Quraysh tribe. His father died before his birth. His mother died at age 6. He was raised by his uncle, whose name was Abu Talib. He was a shepherd. He was poor. He became a trader. He traveled up to Syria. He worked for a wealthy lady by the name of Khadija. He eventually married Khadija. She was 40. He was 25. They had 6 children, 2 boys, 4 girls. Travels, as I said, carried him to Palestine, carried him to Syria. He was exposed to the Monophysite and Nestorian form of Christianity. Muhammad was a religious man, no denying of that. He meditated in caves. During a meditation and a period in 610 AD, there was an event that changed his life. He had a vision of the angel Gabriel. What was this vision? He says the vision said to him, "Recite in the name of your Lord, who created mankind from a clot of blood. Recite, for your Lord is most generous. By the pen, he taught man what he did not know." He didn't know what to make of this vision. Khadija assured him that he was such a just and righteous man that the vision had to be coming from God. Allah, it had to be coming through Gabriel. He wondered if he was having demonic dreams. He did not know, but Khadija assured him it had to be from Allah because Muhammad was too good a man for it to be from Satan. Notice I had in my notes here the subjectivism of the beginning of Islam. It was subjective that he determined that his vision was from God. Had no revealed way to do that. It's totally subjective. From 610 to 622, he remained in Mecca. He focused his teaching on Allah. He taught slowly at first. Early converts, not many. His cousin Ali was one. A friend, Abu Bakr, his son-in-law, Athan. What was he teaching? He was teaching that Allah is God alone. He was teaching that the duty of man is to submit to Allah. The word Islam means submission. It doesn't mean peace. It doesn't mean anything else but submission in its tightest form. One thing to note is the revelations he received while he was in Mecca, while he and his followers were in a minority position, were calm revelations. They included teachings to respect and show mercy to, quote, people of the book, which was referencing Christians and Jews. He spoke these calm revelations because he was in the minority. His followers were not great at this time. 622, he's forced out of Mecca. One reason he's forced out is because he was hurting commerce. Mecca was a place where the polytheistic gods were worshipped. There was a Kaaba, a stone there, that people came and worshipped the many gods. He was hurting commerce. I think we remember Ephesus, a time when Paul hurt commerce by affecting the local religion. He was driven out, went to the town of Medina, fled to Medina. A flight is called Haraj. How do you say it? Hejra? Hejra? Anyway, the immigration. He goes, and the leader of Medina, whose name was Yathrib, offered him safety. He formed a large army when he was there. And it's interesting, in the next 8 years, that his message became much more aggressive, much more violent. while he was there, the monotheistic religion that he had taught shifted to a monotheistic, a monotheistic philosophy of religion and politics. Politics and philosophy came a part of his message. Conquest and submission to Allah by the sword, if necessary, became part of his message. These messages were given from the Medina days when he had an army to back him up. The revelations changed, as I said, and the focus was war. 630. The focus changed, the conquest of Arabia and then the world. 630, he retook Mecca. He crushed the idols. He went to Kaaba. He removed all things except the one stone, and he said, this will represent our place to worship God, Allah. When Muslims make pilgrimages to Mecca today, they make the pilgrimage to worship at this shrine. I could never find in 3 years a picture of the shrine. I could find a picture of the building, but not a picture of the actual stone itself. It's interesting that when he retook Mecca with the army behind him, he crushed the idols and he murdered his opposition. Kind of a trend beginning to be here. 632, he died peacefully. When he died, the region had been unified or united politically and spiritually. So do I have? O Muslims, Abu Bakr, his follower, wrote, if any of you have been worshiping Muhammad, then let you tell that Muhammad is dead. But if you really do worship God, then you know that God is living and will never die. What happened after he died? Abu Bakr became the first leader, a caliph after. I had a little note here. Muhammad married several times. His first marriage was for love. His second marriage was for diplomatic purposes, to remove his enemies. If you married the leader of other clans, they came under you. His third marriage was for tribal things, peace between the tribes. His last marriage was to a young girl named Aisha. He was betrothed to her at 6, consummated at 9. This was a marriage, I won't say what it was a marriage of. And it's interesting, though, she plays a significant part in Islam. Remember her name. The four horsemen of Muhammad. The four followers right after Muhammad that, as you would say, secured and spread the religion. Abu Bakr, his cousin, was the first caliph. A caliph is a deputy successor. He knew how to carry out offensive war. He had three goals: secure the Arabian Peninsula, secured Muhammad's message. He produced the first version of the Quran, and secured Muhammad's command. No two religions are to exist in the Arab Peninsula. No two religions were allowed to coexist in the Arab Peninsula. The teachings of Muhammad, the Muslim faith, was the only thing. It does not coexist with other religions. It does not coexist with other religions. The second leader, this phrase, the Apostle Paul of Islam, I got this from the Kaner Brothers book. They use this. Some people have taken umbrage to me putting that up there, so I will tell you now, if you don't, it's not my choice. The reason they describe this second man is this, because he was responsible, really, for the spread of Islam. From 634 to 644, you cannot imagine the territory that was acquired. Syria in 634, Jerusalem, Antioch, 17 additional towns by 636, Egypt by 639, Persia by 642. The spread of Islam was tremendous under this gentleman. I think I have a map up here. By 750, you can see that Islam, and I don't know how well you can see it, the colored things show the areas of its spread. That under Muhammad, you were looking here. under the next set of caliphs that we're talking about, it spread to here, and finally it spread all the way up to northern Africa and into the Iberian Peninsula, into all of present-day Spain that we see like that. By 750, all of these lands had come under the control of the Muslim religion. This second caliph, Umar, was considered a political genius. He was considered, though, a just caliph. I don't know why. How do Muslims view the world? Dar al-Islam, territory where Muslim governments institute Sharia law, and it is the control. This is, to the Muslim, the goal of everything. But you also have Dar al-Hab. What is that? This is territory where Islamic rule is not present. The whole world is divided to this in their minds. We must note, though, that you can have this even where Muslim governments are if Sharia law is not the law of the land. They do not view Muslim governments that are not total governments with total control as being Dar al-Islam. They want Dar al-Islam to be total Muslim control. So, this provides justification in their mind for attacking Muslims who do not agree with their ultimate, what we will see, radical and possibly true form of Islam. The Muslim, he doesn't know pluralism. It doesn't fit in his mentality. I put that even that. This can exist within Muslim countries where Sharia is not the recognized law of the land. Islam had civil wars. Uthman from 644 to 656 was a former Persian slave. He murdered Umar. He was most concerned for his own tribe and his own tribe's well-being. It's interesting, that happens in Islam a lot, that who is the caliph takes care of his own. It is a tribal religion gone universal. The elements of a tribal religion exist within Islam, obviously, today, because you take care of your people. Uthman did codify the Quran, and most editions of the Quran today bear his name. Following Uthman, was Ali bin Abu Talib, 650 to 661. He was Uthman's son-in-law. He was Muhammad's cousin. He was opposed by the Muslims who were led by Ashai. Remember her, that last wife of Muhammad? Ashai and her followers said that the caliph should be a direct descendant of Muhammad. Ali ibn Abu Talib said it should be the most qualified person. Ashai's followers today are the Shiites, and we know the area that the Shiites control. Ali's followers are the Shiites. Ashai's followers are the Sunnis. You know what? Yeah, that's right. I just made a misstatement. Ali said that it had to be a direct descendant, like a cousin, a blood relative. Ashai said that it should be the best person for the post. I totally flipped that when I stated the first time. Ashai's followers are the Sunnis, which make up the vast majority of Muslims today. Ali's followers are the Shiites. As you know, these have been enemies from this time, and they remain enemies today. The Shias and the Sunnis do not get along. The conflict that you will have between Shias and Sunnis is shown even by Saudi Arabia today, which is Sunni, and Iran, which is Shia. The Saudis will not allow the Iranians to exert the influence that they want to eventually, because it promotes the Iranian Shiite version of Muslim view rather than the Sunni version. Okay. Following are several divisions that the Kaner brothers continued to give about Islam. The Blessed Fruit of Islam, they called it, from 661 to 1095, was the carrying out of the full vision to conquer the world. Through 732, that goal was obtained. We know that. 741, they were in Spain. They were through Damascus, through Jerusalem. What would be the turning point and the stopping of this? 740 A.D., the Battle of Tours. Well, that's the map again, showing how their conquest by 750 or 730 was that far. 732, the turning point was at the Battle of Tours. Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, stopped. I wish you could hear the full description of how this battle occurred. God's providence. We look at it and see God's providence in setting the forces the way they were. This stopped the spread of Islam through the middle part of Western Europe. It sent it back to Spain. Had this not happened, it's unimaginable what Western history would have been. You wouldn't have had Western history. If you had, you know, if they had got the foothold in France, Gaul, and maintained that, which they probably would have had they defeated Charles Martel. You could do a lesson or a lecture sometime on God's providence in war. You can go through centuries how God arranged things to stop certain people, to allow certain things that His will would be worked out. Anyway, the focus after the loss here turned to the east. Baghdad rises in prominence. It was the greatest period of Muslim intellectual advancement. They developed the pendulum for the clock. They developed the magnetic compass. They developed algebra. They had a magnificent library in Baghdad, including Plato, Aristotle, etc. The life of the Messenger of God was written at this time, and this codified who Muhammad was. Cairo came into prominence. Al-Azhar University was formed. I think it was around the 9th century when Al-Azhar, this is the first true university in the world, was this university. Muslim intellectual life was strong at this time. That is why it's such a contrast for the non-intellectual parts that are in control today. The Crusades, come on, we won't discuss that, but we will say the front line of Muslims moved further east. They had to defend themselves against Genghis Khan. Islam was restored to splendor, they say, from 1515 to 1919, and this is for one reason and one reason only, and that is the rise of the Ottoman Empire. It's interesting. Did I bring the book with me? Yeah. Pastor David Dykstra's book on Yearning to Breathe Free. He gives a quote out of the biography of John Adams, which was written by McCullough. Great, great biography, by the way. I'd suggest you read it. But the Ottomans, as our enemy, you remember the Marine Corps hymn, don't you? From the shores of Tripoli, you know how the Marine Corps came really to be in prominence like that. It's when we had to go against the Barbary pirates. The Sultan of Tripoli sent an envoy to John Adams. He said, the sooner, you see, up till this time, all the countries had paid tribute to these Barbary pirates to keep commerce flowing. England paid, France paid. If you wanted your ships to sail through the Mediterranean, you paid. And they were being held hostage. And they paid. And they came to the Americans to pay. And the envoy of the Sultan said to John Adams, the sooner peace was made between America and the Barbary states, the better. Were a treaty delayed, it would be more difficult to make. A war between Christian and Christian was mild. prisoners were treated with humanity, but warned His Excellency a war between Muslims and Christians could be horrible. And it was, because when the Muslims took prisoners, they didn't know anything about a Geneva Convention. They treated them with the utmost of horror, which is how they treat their prisoners today. So, the way they treat prisoners today is a product of the way they have always viewed their enemy. Always viewed their enemy. Anyway, the rise of the Ottoman Empire since 1919, really, they've somewhat been on the defensive, but they've always been brutal. What are the teachings, the doctrine, the practice, and authority of Islam? We'll quickly go through this. The Quran, obviously, is their holy book. It was first gathered right after Muhammad's death, and then about 15 years later, the version that's used today. It is said that unless you can read it in Arabic, you cannot really read it because it's not proper to translate it into any other language. So if you ever discuss with a Muslim scholar, Islamic scholar, they will tell you that you can't really read the Quran because you can't read Arabic. Second source of their authority, the books of the Hadith. What are the Hadith? That's the verified accounts of the Prophet's words and actions, what he said, what he did. These were collected by his wives, by his friends. It's six books. This is a cover of an official copy. It goes to the point of even telling you, oh, that's great. You know, never, never give a Muslim your left hand. Do you know why? I think you'd imagine. You use your left hand to cleanse yourself. And so that would be very improper. It tells you this in the Hadith. It tells you that you can't touch with the left hand because you used your left hand. So all of these things are in the Hadith, the sayings and the actions of Muhammad that have been written down. Third form of their teaching is Sharia, the books of the law. Some of these are ancient. Some of them actually are modern. It can be added to as the imams have greater light. This is what the Muslims prefer to be the law of the land. No, prefer would be a wrong word. They demand that this be the law of the land. Five pillars or doctrines or practices of Islam: the Shahada, statement of faith, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. They say that, they say it, they say it, and they say it over and over again. Someone can say it. The Salah, the prayers. Prayers are offered five times a day. They bow towards Mecca. One thing to always remember, there's no spontaneous prayers with a Muslim. It is all a recited prayer. It is not a spontaneous prayer. Zakah, the giving of alms. Someone called it socialism in religious dress. You have to give 2.5% of everything, supposedly given to the poor. We know it's given to other purposes. The swam, the fasting. This happens in the month of Ramadan. This is to honor the arrival of the Quran. No food or drink in daylight. Do they eat when the sun goes down? Do they eat to the sun? That's okay. The Hajj, the pilgrimage. Every good Muslim should try once in his life to go to Mecca. It's a five-day ritual. It's an amazing amount of people that do it. Why is it so important for Muslims to do what Allah tells them to do? It's important for this reason. Islam is a religion of works. Interest, paradise, or heaven must be earned. There's no assurance for the Muslim. Die, you go to a strange place, you wait judgment. What's going to happen then? As it says in this verse of the Quran, "Thereas for him whose balance of good deeds will be heavy, he will live a pleasant life in paradise. But as for him whose balance of good deeds will be light, he will have his home in Hajwa, or the pit, or hell." There is no forgiveness in Islam. There's no assurance in Islam. You have to obey and obey and obey again. University of Michigan, 2003, in a question and answer series, that Ravi Zacharias was holding, which you can get on DVD and watch, by the way. It's very, very good. A Muslim student says, you know, I know the Ten Commandments, but he says, that's not nearly enough to live. And Ravi thanks him for his question. And you see, to the Muslim, they have six books of this, down to the most innate thing of what they're supposed to do. You have to know exactly what to do. They probably tell you how to sit here and listen to a lecture. I don't know, I'm being facetious. But everything has to be regulated because there is no forgiveness. It is all a religion of works. You have to work. You have to work. You don't know if you're forgiven. You certainly have no assurance of heaven except for one way. I bet you can guess where that is. Jihad. Jihad. What is jihad? Is it struggle? Yes. Is it moral? Should be moral struggle. But to say that it is a moral struggle only is a misstatement of what jihad is. It is a military struggle. It is a contract between Allah and the Muslim to fight the enemy of Allah until the enemy dies or the Muslim dies. What does the contract promise? Jihad is fighting anybody who stands in the way of spreading of Islam or fighting anyone who refuses to enter into Islam. The contract, and it gives them a promise, come down. Let those believers who sell the life of this world for the hereafter fight in the cause of Allah. Whoso fights in the cause of Allah and is killed or gets victory, we shall bestow on him a great reward. This is a promise to them, the only promise they can receive of eternal life, the only assurance that they can receive that they will. I mean, if you die in jihad, you are going to the right place. There's no balancing of your works because this is the work that assures your entrance into heaven. I want to tell you, that is a strong assurance. You can see how it plays out in the mentality of people today. That's what I'm going to get to. For them, Allah gets ready the gardens, paradise, under which rivers flow to dwell therein. This is the supreme success. It even goes to how they are buried. Assurance of forgiveness. Paradise. Paradise. Can you imagine a poor family with sons and daughters who are offered two things? They're offered money and they're offered heaven for their child. I can remember 17, even though it was 42 years ago. I would have done I did a lot of crazy things at 17. And if you had assured me of 70 virgins and my mom and daddy being taken care of, strap it on. I mean, it really, not being facetious, it's not a hard thing to imagine. As foreign as it is to our mind, it's not a hard thing to imagine. Jihad is a command to all Muslims enforced by the Quran. Those who reject Islam must be killed. If they turn back from Islam, take hold of them and kill them wherever you find them. The cover of World Magazine 2 weeks ago had the picture of the Mediterranean girl and it had infidel on it. Do y'all get World Magazine? If you don't, you should subscribe to World Magazine. I'll be happy to sign you up. I get nothing for it, but you get 50 weeks a year of news from a Christian worldview perspective. Anyway, the picture of this girl, she was considered nothing but a sheep's fat put out in the sun. Why? Because she had converted from Islam to Christianity. She converted from atheism. She did. I didn't read the article. I just saw the cover. But she's still considered sheep's fat in the sun. Okay. But any Islam, any follower of Muhammad that converts to anything else, you can't convert to anything else. This is what would await you. Let the unbelievers think they get better, whatever, we're going. Prepare to fight the unbelievers. I need to go to my next lecture, Scott, here. Hold on. I just need to, this is fine. I just need to go to the next one down. I've got the second one. Okay. Whoop. I hit the, reckon I need to hit that little thing down there, don't I? Huh? There you go. Huh? Whoop. Now I need to go back. Hold on. Hold on. Let's go up to the first slide so we know where to start. And now let's go down to the little button here. God has not made my fingers small enough to use mouse, to use those little pointer things. Oh, Islam is spread through military conquests. We've reviewed that. How do they treat the native inhabitants of other religions? They allowed them to exist if they paid a heavy tax for the privilege of living in Muslim lands. Severe restrictions on conversions. Results, most lands slowly converted. They converted to Islam. Other religions died away. There are many examples of severe persecution. We talked about the spread. Let's get up there. Okay. Hold on. Let me back up just a second. Whoop. Let me back up just a second. When Islam comes to a land, you have three choices. You can accept it. You can pay a tax and live as a second-class citizen. You can reject it and die. That's what Islam allows you to do when Islam becomes the law of the land. It does not allow you equal citizenship. Do you think you can go to Saudi Arabia and be a Christian? I mean, you know, our chaplains during the first Gulf War had to take the cross of the Star of David off of their caps or their helmets. Why? It was such an offense to the Muslims, and they would probably be killed by a sniper or something like that. There's no equality. It does not exist. Islam spread by force. It exists by force. Muslims must fight. They are allowed to kill four times people. If they don't believe in Allah, if you don't believe in Last Judgment, etc., etc. The spread of Islam through the practice of jihad. Hold on. Okay, I got ahead of myself here. Give me just a second. Let me see where I am. Yeah, anyway, we're not going to go through all those things. They could accept the message. They could remain Jews or Christians by paying a tax. They could die. Let the unbelievers think they can get the better of the godly. They will never. Against them, you make strength the utmost of your power, etc. How do you answer? How do the Islamic people answer contradictions? That there are some texts, like many texts like this, that say fight. There are a few texts that say allow to live. They answer it by the principle of Nash. This says that the later revelations take precedence over the earlier revelations of Muhammad. His earlier revelations, which were probably about 104 verses that speak about nice things, were all given when he was in the minority. When he became in the majority, he stopped giving the nice things. There's like 9,000 verses that aren't nice and 104 that are. And so I just don't think you can take the 104 and say that that's the principle of Islam. Why is jihad so important and attractive? We've gone over that. Islam is a religion of works. Let those who live to get killed a victory, we shall bestow on him a great reward. It's a powerful incentive. All right, let's run through the balance of this. Do all Muslims hold the view of jihad? Secular Muslims believe the nice parts of the Quran. They reject jihad. They like poetry. They like pageantry. They do not like war. They approve of male domination, like in Turkey today. But this is not representative of Islam. traditional Muslims. They like to study the jihad principles, form a stumbling block, so they call them spiritual struggles. One element in Muslims today are called Sufis, Sufism. One guy that Bill O'Reilly often has on is a Sufi, and he's nice, and he's pleasant, and he's sweet. He doesn't represent Islam today. There are Sufis, but I mean, they're about maybe 1% of the population. But he's good for a talking head for the United States, because people want to think that that's the majority, and the people that are bombing us, they're in the minority. Just ain't so. They know jihad is fighting, but they refuse to accept it. They say, I have no ability. I'm concerned for my family's welfare. I want to live life on this earth. Kind of sounds like I don't know what it sounds like. You know, secularists, thank you. Fundamentalists, Muslims, they want to live life as Muhammad did. Where do these fundamentalist Muslims come from? They come from Wahhabism. What is Wahhabism? Muhammad ibn Abdul al-Wahhab, you see his dates, he was an imam who wanted to restore pure action and practice to the Muslim faith. You could call him a fundamentalist. You could call him puritanical, with a small p. He wanted actions to be done exactly the way he said. Significantly, he made his first allegiance or alliance with the House of Saud in 1744. This launched his campaign of purification and renewal. The Saudi ruler embraced this. They set up the shrine at Karbala. 1818, his forces and the Saudis were defeated by the Ottomans, etc. But the second alliance was set up by the Wahhabis with Ibn Saud, who is the head of the Saudi family that is in rule today. After the fall of the Ottomans in World War I, there was a vacuum of power in the Muslim world. This established the power. The Wahhabi imams with the Saudi Sultan. It established Saudi Arabia from 1915 to 1926. He was the custodian of the holy places. But the second thing, and the major thing, was oil. 1933, the agreement between Standard Oil brought money into Saudi Arabia to an nth degree. Bernard Lewis, a Muslim scholar at Princeton, says, as you read, the custodianship of the holy places, the revenues of oil have given worldwide impact to what would otherwise be extremist fringe in a marginal country. And that's it. It is oil money that has put Saudi Arabia on the map and has put Wahhabism on the map as the primary teaching in Islam. With Saudi money, they go to areas, poor areas. They establish schools. And what are the schools? They're Islamic schools. And what do they teach? They teach Wahhabism. Loudoun County, Virginia is an Islamic school built here on our land, in our country. What is the doctrine taught in that school? Wahhabism. Where is the money for that school coming from? Saudi Arabia. They have the madrasas, the schools. If they have the schools, they have the minds. And that's the spread of fundamentalist, which is radical Islam. It's Wahhabism. Interesting. after 9/11, they take out an ad in the Wall Street Journal, and they even acknowledge that Wahhabism is the foundation of the Saudi government and the Saudi mindset, and it's a good thing. The quote of it, Dykstra has it here in the book. It's very interesting, the quote that they put. I think I put down page 60, something like that. I'll even read you. Do I do that? Da, 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 da. The Wall Street Journal. Okay. The most important of the early ancestors of Al-Saud family was Muhammad Ibn Saud, who was born in 1710. He was a local ruler. He forged a political and family alliance with the Muslim scholar and reformer Muhammad Ibn Abd al-Wahhi. Muhammad Ibn Saud agreed with Ibn's burning desire to revive a pure Islam in its simplest and original form. They don't deny. That is their doctrine, and it's a doctrine of Islam being practiced the way you see it practiced in Saudi Arabia. Radical Islam. How did it come about? It came about through a period of national terrorism. National terrorism works. Remember the Greeks in Cyprus, the French in Algeria, the British in Aden. If you go against them enough, they're going to leave and leave you alone. Islam realizes that. Religious terrorism. Collateral damage is okay. It's not even preferable. It's not limited to the objective. It has wants to influence world opinion by fear. Fear is what it goes by. Fear is what it goes by. Fear. It wants you to fear them so you do not oppose them, and before you know it, you are under them. How did it develop? The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Sayyid Khatib, he was a scholar, came to America in 1948, couldn't imagine the beauty of America and all the resources here, but what an immoral people. What an immoral people. I don't think I'm going to go through his quotes and everything about him. His followers attempted to assassinate President Nasser twice. Finally, Qutb was hung in 1965. His books were banned. That's a good thing. You ban someone's books and they rise in importance. He was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. One of his followers, Shakura Mustafa, he entered into jihad with a vengeance and a passion. He attacked the police. He attacked the military government, the military forces. He attacked religious leaders. All who supported the government of Egypt, he attacked because he wanted to see radical Islam established in Egypt. He was executed in 1977, but his ideas live on in a book he wrote called The Leader. Follower of his, the blind Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, professor at University of Al-Azhar. It's interesting. A gentleman who goes by another name now was trained at Al-Azhar, and when he was a student there, he asked the Rahman about the passages of peace and the contradiction with war. He quotes and he answers him. He says, "My brother, there is a whole surah or chapter called The Spoils of War. There is no surah called peace. Jihad and killing are the head of Islam. If you take them out, you cut off the head of Islam." Jihad is the head. It is the principle. It is killing. It's the way that it will spread. We know that he is in prison here in the United States today for the leading of the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. We could go over many other things about the way they hate America and the way they feel justified in attacking us and anything represents us, Osama bin Laden and all of that. But I want to conclude with one additional thing here. If I may, I've got four slides that I don't know how to put these all together. It's the beginning of a third lecture right here. Okay. What do Muslims think about Christianity? What do they think about Christianity? They have five. They think that we have unbelief. They have belief because they have a confession. And that confession leads them to know Allah and to honor Allah in all things. They believe that the Christian gospel has been changed. They think that what was taught was changed, and only with Muhammad has it been refound. Historical evidence, we know, affirms Christianity. Perception number two, Christians are weak and divided. Hey, we can't deny that. Christians are weak. Christians are divided. But Islamic apologists claim that all Muslims are united under one Shaditha and the five pillars. All believers in Allah are required to pray similarly. They're given equally and fast annually. Christians cannot even agree on what Bible to use. Well, you know, he's right about that. But what is the answer? What is the response to that? Do you think that Muslims are not divided? The Shias, the Sunnis, the Sufis, and every other ism within those things. I mean, you have Shias who oppose each other because one are from one tribe and one is from another tribe. It is still a tribal religion. So you can't say that Christianity is to be opposed because we're weak and divided. We're both divided. Perception three, Christians have maligned true Islam. That's what they say. They say that we use the Quran out of context. You don't. You read the Quran, that is its context. We have not done that. The problem is not what Christians say about Muslims. The problem is not what Christians say about Muslims as much as it is what Muslims say about themselves due to their ongoing intolerance. They are the ones that define intolerance. Perception four, Christians are blind and unreasonable. You know, there's some element of truth to that. Muhammad could not get a clear answer from Christians as to what they believe. They cannot explain the faith. Muslims today believe that Christians cannot defend the Bible, Jesus as the Son of God, or the Trinity. And you know, to some degree, they probably have something right there, because Christians are so untaught. But everybody they call a Christian is not a Christian. And that is the thing that you have to come back to. The Christian faith is reasonable. It can be understood. The Trinity is incomprehensible to many Christians. I mean, you know, when you get right down to try to explain the Trinity like that, a Muslim could not understand it. Okay. Faith is reasonable. Eyewitness testimony of the gospel is more credible than legends about Muhammad. Even pagan testimony leaves no doubt of Christ's crucifixion. Jesus was seen by over 500 eyewitnesses. There's more things to verify the Christian faith than ever there could be about Muhammad. Their fifth perception, Christian faith overlooks immorality. You know what? They got a point there. But the reason that they can make this point is because they define Christianity as the religion of the West. And they see governments as Christian governments, and therefore this is allowed. I mean, there is no denying that. We have to tell them that Western nations are not Christian nations. You cannot put the two together. Christian intellectual response to Islam must reflect a personal Christian commitment, because a person who knows right and habitually does wrong persuades no one. Christians are called upon to transform their minds and their entire selves. Someone listed the Ten Commandments for sharing the gospel with Muslims. I don't necessarily agree with all of these, but I'm going to list them for you, and I don't know what's the most... I'm going to tell you what I think the most important is. Excuse me, I'm going to tell you what I think Ravi Zacharias thinks the most important is when we get through with the ten. Use the Word of God. Be consistent or constant in prayer. Be a genuine friend. If you've ever heard of friendship evangelism, it will happen here. You will not speak to a Muslim unless you can show yourself to be their friend. They won't go to the corner and listen to the preacher. Come on, give me number four. Ask thought-provoking questions. Do you have assurance that God will accept you? What does the Quran teach about forgiveness? May I show you what the Bible teaches? Listen attentively. Number five, present your beliefs openly. Reason, do not argue. And never, never, never denigrate Muhammad or the Quran. You will totally stop your conversation with a Muslim if you speak disparagingly about Muhammad. Respect their customs and sensitivities. Don't shake with the left hand, etc. Some things like that. Persevere, this person says. This was given by a guy who's taken the name Mark Gabriel. He was converted. He was the one that was the student there at Al-Azhar that gave us the quote from that. A young Muslim student by the name of Hani took the mic at the University of Michigan to ask Ravi Zacharias questions. And Hani actually got to ask a couple of questions. You don't get to ask a couple of questions unless you're good at what you're doing. And Hani was extremely respectful, and he asked penetrating questions to Dr. Zacharias, penetrating questions. Ravi told him, he says, "Young man, please come see me when this is over." He wanted to see, because this was a good Muslim who probably knew more about Christianity than a lot of people who claim to be Christians. He was sincere in his questions. But Ravi said, and someone asked the question, or the question was written and was read to him, what would you say the primary thing and the primary message that you take in dealing with a Muslim? And he says, the primary message that we believe that we take to the Muslim world is God is love. He said, that is an attribute of God that they cannot imagine. God is love. He loves His creation. God has love. He is love. And He said, that is the message that we emphasize. And I will tell you that I believe that the ministry of RZIM is reaching in the Muslim world in places that very few or if any other people are going. Michael Ramston, who is the scholar at Oxford, who's the RZIM representative there, after speaking in Albania, and Ravi and Michael have been in Albania three times, speaking to the Senate, the President, Michael was invited and carried under a false passport to one of the Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, I don't know which one it was, one of those countries by the oil minister several months ago. He says, my people need to hear. And he spoke to the leaders of this Muslim country about the exclusive claims of Jesus Christ. Now, that was an announced meeting. And they would deny it even took place. But they're getting into these places, and the thing that they emphasize is the faithfulness of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who is a God of love. Love is not known in the Islamic world. Well, thank you for your attention. I'm sorry that I didn't. I messed up a few times on my slides, but that's the combination of three things put together. And if you have questions, I'll try to answer them one-on-one. Thank you so much for your time.